for part three, Rabbi Lakshin, Rabbi Dr. Martin Lakshin, and we'll be starting today on Moshe Mendelssohn, who we just said is probably one of the most misunderstood people, I think, in the last couple hundred years, one who generates much, you know, controversy. And I know in Dr. Lakshin's, you know, style, he'll present them objectively, fairly, and we'll get a beautiful picture this week and next week on Mendelssohn, a little bit who he was, but more important, his contribution to the study of our Chumash. Bakasha, Dr. Lakshin.
Thank you very much. Following what Rabbi Kelman said, I felt that before we look at his Bible commentary, we have to actually talk about his character, his personality, his ideology, because as Rabbi Kelman said, he was a... He is a very misunderstood person. I went to the same high school that Rabbi Kelman went to, and that you went to Chatz.
I went to Orchaim. No, I went to Orchaim already. I teach in Chatz.
I went to the same high school that Rabbi Kelman teaches at, the Community Hebrew Academy of Toronto. And when I was in high school, our history teacher had us put on a mock trial of Moses Mendelssohn. And it was my job to be the prosecutor in the trial. And I was supposed to be arguing that he was so terrible for the Jewish people that we should not be teaching about him in the curriculum at the Community Hebrew Academy of Toronto, because he led to the destruction of the Jewish people in many ways. As often happens in a debate, I was asked to be debating a position that I did not believe, and nor do I believe it at this point of time either, that he was a terrible person for the Jewish people. In fact, to a certain degree, I would argue that almost any of us who consider ourselves to be a modern Orthodox Jew or a modern religious Jew, a modern traditional Jew, in many senses, all of us are followers of Moses Mendelssohn to one degree or another. And I'll try to explain what I mean by this. Let me just share my screen with you. Moses Mendelssohn did not live for a long time, lived in the 18th century in a very interesting time for the world when changes were taking place in the United States of America, being created in this time, and various nation states being created in Europe, where that there was a certain commitment to a larger extent or to a smaller extent to democracy and to the idea that everybody who lives in the country should be allowed to be participating in this democracy. But not everybody was certain that all groups should be included. We all know that women were not enfranchised for quite a long time after the 18th century. So democracies were being created, but half of the population was being excluded from taking part in the voting or in serving in political positions. And other groups were not being enfranchised also. Mendelssohn was not a full-time scholar. He made his living as a merchant. He was a hunchback. We'll see a story here about people laughing at Mendelssohn. He was not, apparently not a handsome looking man. He was an observant Jew. We'll talk more about this, but there is no doubt that he was Shomer Torah u'mitzvot. While he never had an academic position in a university, he was a philosopher. One year they had a philosophy essay contest in Israel, and Moses Mendelssohn won first prize, and Immanuel Kant came in second in that prize. And his works of philosophy were read not just by Jews, but also by non-Jews. He was a big proponent of enlightenment. and of emancipation. Emancipation meaning that the Jews should be given rights in Europe, and not everybody felt that the Jews should be given rights in Europe. Now, in order to give them rights, he was arguing that the Jews had to become enlightened, that they had to study the curriculum that non-Jews were studying, the curriculum that wasn't of a religious nature, that was a necessary ticket in order for them to become part of German or French society. And in the same way that there are arguments in this country, here in the state of Israel these days, about whether Haredi schools should be required to be teaching what we call here Mikzaot HaLiba, the core subjects like arithmetic, and English has suddenly, for some reason, become one of the core subjects here in Israel. Is that necessary for people who wish to be part of society? Is there a core curriculum that is required that people should be studying? And Mendelssohn was very in favor of the fact that the idea that Jews should have this curriculum. And as I said, you know, anybody who's tuned in to this Torah in Motion program presumably agrees with Moses Mendelssohn about this, that it's a good idea for Jews as part of their education to learn some mathematics, to learn some geography, and not just to learn a Talmud. And I assume that most people who are tuned in here also think that it's very nice that Jews who live in the United States or in Canada or any country in the world that isn't the state of Israel should be part of the demos, part of the people, part of the democratic structure of the society, able to vote, able to serve in public office, able to be among the people who are making the decisions about the country. This was a controversial idea in the 18th century. This had never been tried before the 18th century, the idea that the idea that the Jews could be identified as being part of the French people or the German people. There was much discussion about issues of emancipation in the 18th century. At the end of the 18th century, Comte Clermont-Tonnerre in France said, the Jews should be denied everything as a nation, but guaranteed everything as individuals. The existence of a nation within a nation is unacceptable to our country. So I think Clermont-Tonnerre here understood something very, very important, that if the Jews wanted to become part, he argued that the Jews wanted to become part of the French people, he thought it was a good idea. They should become part of the French people, and they should vote, and they should serve in the army, and they should be eligible to be elected to public office. But then they have to stop thinking of themselves as being a nation. And there were a lot of Jews who were against the idea of emancipation because they wanted to continue to think of themselves as a nation. They didn't want to be Germans. They didn't want to be French people. And perhaps, I don't know if there was opposition even in the United States, but maybe there was also there some Jews who did not want to become part of the political process. Probably the people who went to the New World were all on side about this. And so Moses Mendelssohn and other people, but he was like the strongest and most well-known spokesman for the idea of the emancipation of the Jews. Moses Mendelssohn was fighting against non-Jews who were saying, not like Clermont-Tonnerre, but Mendelssohn was in correspondence with non-Jews who were saying, Jews can't be part of our society. Just we look at the way they are, and they don't want to eat with us. They don't want to observe the same holidays as us, and so they're not really Germans, or they're not really French people. And so Mendelssohn was arguing against non-Jews who didn't want the Jews to becoming part of their society. And he was also arguing against Jews who liked the idea of Jews staying separate from the society. I'll say a couple of words of further introduction here. I'm just going to give a little footnote here and say that almost everything that I'm going to be saying about Mendelssohn today, I either learned from somebody that I think many of you in Canada know, Eddie Breuer, who a Canadian who now lives here and teaches here in Jerusalem, and has written a number of fine books about Moses Mendelssohn, a book specifically about Moses Mendelssohn's commentary on the Torah, and this other book that he wrote recently together with David Sorkin, Moses Mendelssohn's Hebrew Writings, that we'll be making use of today. And I will also give a footnote to my old professor, Alexander Altman, who was one of the world's experts on Mendelssohn. I did my PhD at Brandeis University, and my first semester as a PhD student was Professor Altman's last semester before retirement. And so I took the last course that he ever taught at a university before his retirement. And I remember as I was preparing this lecture, I was thinking to myself, gee, he was such an old man when I took that course with him. And then I looked up to see when Professor Altman was born, and I'm a little older right now than that old man who taught me. He seemed ancient when I studied with him when I was 24 or 25 years old. So those are the places where I have my understanding of Moses Mendelssohn from. I learned over the years that a number of the things that I learned at CHAT, I'm sorry to say this, Rabbi Kelman, but they weren't accurate, some of the things that I learned. The biggest complaint about Moses Mendelssohn that is cited, and that when I had that job of being the prosecutor in the trial of Moses Mendelssohn when I was a high school student, I made hay out of this point, was that almost all of his children converted to Christianity. And among his children who remained Jewish, most of their children converted to Christianity. And that's a fact. Not every one of them, but most of them. Many of you know that my wife's maiden name is Mendelssohn, and when she's often asked, are you a descendant of Moses Mendelssohn? And she says, well, actually, I'm Jewish, and Moses Mendelssohn did not have any Jewish descendants. From our perspective today, this seems damning. We all know, all of us who have been parents or grandparents know that the parents are not actually responsible for what the children end up doing, that there are some fine people who brought up their children well and the children went in different directions. I think we have to understand that world. There were many people who thought in the 18th century, a lot of people who wanted to get emancipated, a lot of Jews who wanted to get emancipated, actually thought that the only way of becoming emancipated was to convert to Christianity. There's even a story of some maskilim, some enlightened Jews going to a Protestant minister in Germany and saying to him, we would like to convert to Christianity, but we would like a dry baptism. What did that mean? They said, we don't believe in Christianity. We're honest people, and we're not going to tell you that we believe in Christianity, but we would like to become Christians because we would like to become part of society. And this group were, of course, kicked out from the by this Protestant clergyman who was an honest person. Many people felt in the 18th century that if Jews wished to become part of a society, like the society in France or the society in Germany or the society even in the United States, that the way to do it was by becoming Christians. I heard a story about a Hebrew school teacher in Toronto, who one time asked her students, she was telling her students about identity and Jewish identity and things like this, and she posed a question to her Hebrew school students. She said, well, let's imagine that there was a rule here in Canada that said that if you want to go to university, you have to be a Christian. What would you do? And she told me that every student in the class said they would convert to Christianity. This teacher learned not to ask that question, and she stopped asking that question of her students. But for most people, it seemed clear people wanted to become part of these societies, and it seemed to make sense that the way to become part of these societies was by converting to Christianity. And Mendelssohn was saying that it wasn't necessary to convert to Christianity. Here's a picture of his reconstructed tombstone. The cemetery where he was buried in Berlin was razed by the Nazis, and then it was turned into this kind of repurposed to be a cemetery for German soldiers who fell that were buried on top of the people in the Jewish cemetery there. But after the war, they did try to recreate Mendelssohn's Matzeva. They knew what it said on it, and so this is a recreated Matzeva for Moses Mendelssohn. Nachacham Rav Moshe Midesau Nolad Yud Beit Elul He Taf Peitet Niftar Biyom Dalet He Shvat VeNikbar LeMochorato Biyom He Vav Bo He Taf Kuf Mem Vav. He was born on such and such a date. He died on Wednesday, the 5th of Shvat. Just realized he died on my mother's yahrzeit, or I guess I should say that my mother, Zichrona Livracha, died on Mendelssohn's yahrzeit. And it's also the yahrzeit of the Sfas Emes. I wonder if the Sfas Emes liked the fact that his yahrzeit was the same day as Moshe Mendelssohn's yahrzeit. And then it says that he was buried on the next day, on Thursday. Rabbi Kelman, are you used to seeing?
This is common. On our trip to Germany, it was common in Europe that they would write the date of death and the date of burial. You see, I believe it's on Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's tombstone, which is one of the most amazing tombstones you can imagine. But I believe it says, right, he died on a Friday and was buried on a Sunday. You know, they would write. It was it's an interesting thing. We've seen that a lot on the tombstones in Europe.
Okay, thank you. I did not know that it was common. And we know that there are different halachot, but when you observe the yahrzeit, some people say in the first year, the yahrzeit is observed on the day of Kfura, and afterwards it's on the day of the passing of the person. I thought that there might be, I was just speculating, there might be some further significance here, because one issue in which Moses Mendelssohn took a stand that was not popular in the Jewish community and that was opposed by the rabbis, the German government or some local government in some part of Germany passed a regulation that when somebody dies, they should not be buried for 3 days after they die, because there were stories about people being buried and they were still alive. And so they said, we have to be sure that people are actually dead. And Mendelssohn said, look, if the government is saying that we have to do this, then we have to do this. And there were rabbis who were very upset about this and wanted to be fighting against it. And here's on Mendelssohn's tombstone, it says that he was buried on the very next day. It's hard to sum up Moses Mendelssohn's philosophy, but here's one line that gets quoted quite a bit. Adapt yourself to the morals and the constitution of the land to which you have been removed, but hold fast to the religion of your fathers. And I think that that's how Mendelssohn lived his life. He held fast to the religion of his fathers, and he adapted himself to the morals and the constitutions of the land in which he was living. You can see, I mentioned how his children left Judaism. Here's a letter that Moses Mendelssohn's son, Abraham, wrote to his children. The outward form of your religion your teacher has given you is historical and changeable like all human ordinances. We taught you a religion, but religion, it doesn't really matter what religion you observe. Religions are changing all the time. Some thousands of years ago, the Jewish form was the reigning one, and then the heathen form, and now it is the Christian. This is an unusual understanding of history of Abraham, the son of Moses Mendelssohn, that first the world was Jewish, and then it was heathen, and then it was Christian. But anyways, we, your mother and I, were born and brought up by our parents as Jews, and without being obliged to change the form of our religion, have been able to follow the divine instinct in us and in our conscience. We've educated you and your brothers and sister in the Christian faith. Why? Because it is the creed of most civilized people. It contains nothing that can lead you away from what is good, and much that guides you to love, obedience, tolerance, and resignation. So, you know, it doesn't really matter what religion you are, is what Abraham Mendelssohn is saying to his children. We were brought up in Judaism, and that worked for us. It didn't make any particular problems for us, but we decided to bring you guys up in Christianity because that's what most people are. This was the common feeling of so many Jews at the end of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century, and the attempt to stop people from leaving Judaism was led by people like Mendelssohn, who said, yes, we can become part of this society without leaving Judaism. Sadly, he did not get that message across very well to his own children. And I learned from this recent book written by Eddie Breuer and David Sorkin that part of the great misinformation about Moses Mendelssohn was created by his son Joseph, who wrote a kind of biography of his father that was filled with all sorts of lies about his father, where Joseph wanted Moses Mendelssohn, his father, to be the person that Joseph was. He wrote there that my father didn't care at all about Shmirat Mitzvot, and he only did it because he thought that he could be an influence on people more effectively if he was Shomer Mitzvot and various other things. I'll mention one further thing when I get to the Torah commentary. That's misinformation that comes from Mendelssohn's own son, Joseph, who converted to Christianity. We'll get to the Torah commentary in a second one. Just last story about Mendelssohn and Immanuel Kant. So show you a little bit about the spirit of the times that we're dealing with at the end of the 18th century in Germany. An eyewitness wrote this story about a small stooped Jew with a goatee and a large hump. I told you he was a hunchback. Entered the lecture hall where Immanuel Kant was lecturing, with anxious tiny steps, stopped and stood not far from the doorway. As was common, mockery and derision, sorry about the typo, mockery and derision broke out that initially led to loud cries, but to everyone's surprise, the stranger stayed put with a rigid calmness as if constrained. The person who wrote an academic article about this story that he found said that they were laughing because they laughed at Jews and they laughed at people. Mendelssohn looked Jewish and he was hunchback, and the university students were just laughing their heads off that somebody like this was showing up in university. As an expression of his determination to wait for the professor, he made his intentions unequivocally clear by occupying a vacant seat. He was approached and asked what he wanted, and he answered briefly and politely that he wished to stay in order to meet Kant. The ruckus ended only with Kant's entrance into the classroom. His lecture, Kant's lecture, diverted the attention of everyone to other things, and one was so spellbound, so sunk in the sea of new ideas that everyone long since forgot the appearance of the Jew, until at the end of the lecture, he pushed through the crowd of students to the lectern with an intensity in stark contrast to his earlier composure. Initially, the students hardly noticed him, but then scornful laughter broke out again, laughing at Mendelssohn there in the university. However, the laughter immediately gave way to silenced admiration because Kant, after a momentary look of great regard and exchange of a few words, warmly shook the stranger's hand and then embraced him. And then word spread like wildfire through the crowd. Moses Mendelssohn, the Jewish philosopher from Berlin. And respectfully, the students formed two rows as the worldly wise men exited the hall, passing between them, holding hands. So Kant and Mendelssohn are walking out of the lecture hall together, holding hands. That's one story by an eyewitness about this. And we also have Kant writing, I don't know if he's writing about the same lecture, but writing about a time that Moses Mendelssohn showed up at one of his lectures. Kant had a number of Jewish students and he wrote to one of them, "Today, Mr. Mendelssohn, your worthy friend and mine, for so I flatter myself, is departing. To have a man like him in Königsberg," that's where Kant was teaching at the university in Königsberg, "on a permanent basis as an intimate acquaintance, a man of such gentle temperament, good spirit and enlightenment, how that would give my soul the nourishment it has lacked so completely here, a nourishment I miss more and more as I grow older. I wish that he'd just move here because I need to have friends like this. I could not arrange, however, to take full advantage of this unique opportunity to enjoy so rare a man, partly from fear lest I might disturb him in the business he had to attend to locally." Mendelssohn had come to Königsberg on business, but while he was there, he said, "Oh, I should go and hear a lecture from Immanuel Kant. Yesterday, he did me the honor of being present at two of my lectures. A la fortune du pote." Kant is, of course, writing in German, but he throws in this French expression, which just means pot luck. You know, he said, The lecture that he heard, I didn't have a chance to work on it, thinking that somebody as great as Moses Mendelssohn would be there. It was just potluck that he got there, not a prepared meal, as one might say, because the table was not prepared for such a distinguished guest. "I beg you to keep for me the friendship of this worthy man in the future." So he was extremely respected in philosophical circles and enlightenment circles among Jews and non-Jews. All of this is a introduction. I apologize if for some of you these things were well known about Mendelssohn. Now we'll start talking about his project of preparing a new translation of the Bible and commentary on the Bible. Mendelssohn himself translated the entire Torah into German written in Hebrew letters. I was taught when I was in high school what his son Joseph said, but I wasn't told that that's what I was told that it's a fact that the reason that he did this is that he wanted Jews to stop speaking Yiddish. And so he prepared a German translation of the Torah instead, so that Jews would start speaking proper German and stop speaking Yiddish. I learned from the book by David Sorkin and Eddie Breuer that this is totally untrue, and that it was just a story that was made up by his son Joseph, who was trying to make his father seem less Jewish than he really was. And Mendelssohn explains in the introduction to the Biur, that's the Chumash that he published, he explains that people have been translating the Bible into the vernacular from the days of Unklos. Unklos did it into Aramaic because that's what Jews understood. They understood they understood Aramaic, and so it makes sense to translate it into the language that they speak. And because not everybody in the Jewish community can read Latin characters, the German characters. And so he wrote it in Hebrew in the same way that, you know, Rambam wrote Arabic, Judeo-Arabic in Hebrew characters, and Mendelssohn wrote this translation into German on written in Hebrew characters. He commissioned Shlomo Dubno, who was a great scholar, to write the commentary on the Torah. Dubno ended up writing the commentary on Genesis, but not the rest. The original plan was that Dubno would do the whole thing, but he left. As you see at the bottom of this slide, it says here, why did Dubno leave the project? Nobody really knows. And Breuer and Sorkin write in their book that there are three theories on the subject. One, money, that he had not realized that it would take so many. He was hired to write this commentary, and he didn't think that it would take as many years as it ended up taking, and he couldn't afford to keep working on this job if it was going to take him so many years to do it. Another theory is that Dubno had written an extremely long introduction to the Chumash commentary, and most of it had to do with Hebrew grammar, and Moses Mendelssohn decided to make it shorter, and Dubno was upset that his work was abridged. And the third explanation is that Dubno was upset with some of the company that Mendelssohn was keeping, that not all the enlightened people with whom Mendelssohn was hanging out were Shomrei Torah Mitzvot, and Shlomo Dubno was a serious Shomer Torah Mitzvot, and not that he was upset that Mendelssohn wasn't, but he was just worried that Mendelssohn was hanging around with the wrong people. So Mendelssohn ended up writing the commentary on Exodus himself, and then he put together a team. He found three people to write the commentaries on Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim. Naftali Hertz Vesely, who was another great scholar, wrote the commentary on Leviticus. And then two lesser-known people, Aaron Yaroslav. I couldn't even find years for when Aaron Yaroslav lived. And I also saw that Sorkin and Breuer in their book did not have any years for Yaroslav. And Naftali Hertz Homburg wrote the commentary on Deuteronomy. And the result was uneven quality. We'll talk about that a little bit, that some of the sections are better than other sections. The first three Chumashim were done by great scholars. And I learned from Sorkin and Breuer's book that in Mendelssohn's letters, he complained bitterly about the job that was done on Devarim by Naftali Hertz Homburg, that he thought that it was not a very good job. In the introduction to the commentary, Mendelssohn wrote the introduction to the commentary, even though he had asked Dubno to do the commentary. In the introduction, he talks about the commentators that he's going to use. And one of the commentators that he says he's going to use and that he ends up using many, many occasions is Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. Now, this might not seem all that unusual, because now in the 21st century and in the second half of the 20th century, almost any time a Mikraot Gedolot is published, a compendium of rabbinic commentaries on the Torah, Rashbam's commentary is included. Rashbam's commentary was not in any Mikraot Gedolot in the 18th century. And in fact, it was only in the 18th century that it was published for the first time in an edition that did not have great distribution. And Mendelssohn came across this commentary and he said, oh, this is a great commentary on the Torah. And part of the reason why Rashbam's commentary got to be known more widely was because Mendelssohn uses it al yamin va'al smol. Throughout his commentary, he's quoting often verbatim and occasionally paraphrasing what Rashbam has to say. And we'll say more about Mendelssohn and Rashbam. And that's not just because I'm interested in Rashbam, as many of you know, but also you'll see the unusual place that Rashbam's commentary plays in Mendelssohn's project. Here's a picture, I'll try to make it a little bit bigger here, of the page from the first edition of Mendelssohn's Chumash. Try just a little bigger. People can sort of see it now. Yes. So you see, here's the text of the Chumash, and here's Targum Ashkenazi. Durch einige Zigre, my German is lousy, but this is the translation into German that Mendelssohn wrote in Hebrew letters. And right underneath the Chumash is the translation into Aramaic by Unklus, which is kind of there to show that it's okay to have a translation into another language. I misspoke. I said this is the first edition. This is the second edition. Actually, the first edition, I wasn't able to get a picture, and it's difficult to get to a library here right now in Israel. And in the first edition of the of his Chumash, Rashi's commentary did not appear, and then he decided, or the group decided, that it was a good idea for Rashi's commentary to be there so that it would be more kosher kind of Chumash. You can see here, for those of you, make it just a little bit bigger here. There is, I see right at the top here, it says Aleph Hey. That stands for.
Can you Amar, center it a little bit? Sorry. Yeah. Good. Just keep going to center the page. Yeah.
Right.
I think a little more probably. I think. Yeah.
Good. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah. Fine. Yes.
Okay. So the last letters here in the second line that you can see are Aleph Hey, which means Amar Hamitargim. The translator is intruding into the commentary. So what was the verse that we were dealing with here? The verse was, we'll go back to the top here. The verse is, Ve'af ba'avonot avotam itam yimaku. This is from the Tochecha, the curses in the book of Vayikra. At the end of Vayikra, it says that they will go to the Jews whose sin will be taken into captivity, and they will be punished for their sins. And then the last line here is Ba'af ba'avonot avotam yimaku, which seems to say, and they will also suffer for the sins of their parents. And that's, of course, problematic, because Judaism, the Torah, teaches lo yumtu avot abanim uvanim lo yumtu avotam ish b'cheto yumatu. And so Wesley, who wrote the commentary on Vayikra, stands on his head to try to figure out what this could possibly mean, but Mendelssohn didn't like it. And so he wrote here, Amar Hamitargim, Chalila la'el lachshov la'adam avon asher lo chata ke'ilu chata. It's impossible to say that somebody will be punished for a sin that they didn't commit. And then he goes on to explain as we say in the Sidur, you know, Mipnei Chataino Galino Me'artzeno, that we were exiled from our land because of our sins, but we weren't there when the exile took place. It was the sins of our people that led to the exile. And Mendelssohn says, sometimes it happens that, you know, there are changes in history that happen because of sin, and then it ends up that the next generation and the generation after that are also born in exile, and not because of their sins, but they're born in exile because of the sins of their fathers. I don't know if that truly solves the theological problem here, but what I always find interesting when I'm looking at Mendelssohn's commentary is this kind of interplay between Mendelssohn and his team. And Wesley, he truly loved and respected, but he intrudes himself a number of times into the commentary this way by putting into square brackets his own, what he thinks is a better interpretation of the text. Okay, now I have to make this smaller again so we can read this. So here's a commentary on the first verse in the book of Devarim. Eileha Devarim asher diber Moshe al kol Yisrael be'ever ha'yarden, b'mibar b'arava mol suf ben paranu ben tofel v'lavan v'chatzerot v'dizahav. These are the words that Moshe spoke to the Jewish people on the other side of the Jordan, in the desert, in the Arava, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel and Lavan and Chatzerot and Dizahav. There are a whole bunch of place names here, and some of them we don't know at all. Rashi comments, he says, Chazarno Kol Mikra, the Lo Matzanu, we went through the entire Bible and we never found any place called Tophel or any place called Lavan. What's going on here? Whether there are place names here and they don't make any sense. And then the further question is this verse describing many places or one place? Now, the most common understanding is it's describing many places. In other words, Moshe gave this speech to the Jewish people in a number of locations. As they were going through the desert, bit by bit, he gave them this speech. Okay. So we look at the Biur. I told you that Mendelssohn wasn't terribly thrilled with the work on the commentary that was done by Homburg, to whom he assigned Devarim. And here we have, I'll just read it in English. All of the terms mentioned in this verse are place names. The text provides signs upon signs on the other side of the Jordan. On which other side of the Jordan? Of course, it depends. The Jordan has two sides, as the old song goes. So what does it mean, the other side of the Jordan? So after you say on the other side of the Jordan, they have to explain which side, the side that's in the desert, in the wilderness. And in the Arava, in other words, i.e. in which place in the wilderness? In the wilderness that one finds in the plains of Moab, near Suf. For the Sea of Suf, the Sea of Reeds, begins at the eastern part of the land of Israel. As it is written, I will set your borders from the Sea of Reeds to the Sea of the Philistines. In other words, that verse describes the borders of the land from the east to the west. The Sea of Suf is the Dead Sea, which is the southeastern corner of the land. Just look at the Hebrew there. Klomar mimizrach ad ma'arav. Vehu yam hamelach. Yam suf is yam hamelach. Shekatuv bigvul keren mizrachit deromit. We know that the Dead Sea is in the southeastern corner of the land. And another name for the Dead Sea is yam suf, the Sea of Suf, or sometimes called the Sea of Reeds. This is very strange. Any of you who ever spend any time here in Israel know that Yam Suf and Yam HaMelech are not the same body of water. And this commentary says that all of these words here, they're all describing one place on the east side of the Jordan River near the Dead Sea. And it's just helping you understand where this speech took place. Now, this would be a fine interpretation if we could accept the possibility that the Dead Sea and Yam Suf are actually the same body of water, but they are not. I'm only slightly embarrassed to say that this comment here that Hertz Homburg wrote on this verse, he copied out verbatim from Rashbam. This is Rashbam's commentary on the verse. And this is happening, as I said, all through the Biur. Things that Rashbam wrote are just being thrown into the Biur. Sometimes at the end, it says in brackets, Rashbam. Here, I don't think it said in brackets, Rashbam, but this is precisely from Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. In the 12th century, when Rashbam wrote that the Dead Sea and the Red Sea are the same body of water, I can't blame him very much, because I've seen some of the maps that they used to have of the Holy Land back in the 12th century, and they have very little connection to they have very little connection to reality, those maps. By the 18th century, there were good maps of the Holy Land, of the land of Israel. And if this Homburg guy had been doing a good job here, I think that he would have realized that he shouldn't be putting in Rashbam's commentary, even though that it was kind of like the go-to position, the default position was when there was a difficult verse where they go and look and see, did Rashbam have something to say about it? He says, oh, okay, so I'll copy out Rashbam and I'll put it into the commentary here. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about Mendelssohn and Rashbam, because this is an important issue in this commentary. So I'll read here in English from Mendelssohn's introduction to his Torah commentary. Rabbi Shlomo Dubno did as I had instructed him. He gathered together the Pshat explanations of scripture from the works of the earlier practitioners of Pshat exegesis, the Rishonei HaPashtanim HaGdolim, from the works of the great luminary Rashi, who has, when he offers a Pshat explanation, no equal. When Rashi does Pshat, that nobody does pshat as well as Rashi when Rashi does pshat, hinting that Rashi is not always doing pshat, as we all know. And from the works of his grandson Rashbam, who delved into the pshat meaning of the text deeply, in fact, sometimes more than is appropriate. So much so that it happens that due to his great love of pshat, he occasionally misses the truth. An amazing line. Ad shela ahavat ha-pshat hu noter lifamim minekudat ha-emet. He loves pshat so much that he forgets about the truth. We'll explain that. Mendelssohn explains it further on what he's saying. And from the works of Ibn Ezra, who was expert in all the sciences, the only criticism that he gives is of Rashbam. He has nothing critical to say about Ibn Ezra, nothing critical about Rashi, maybe a little hint that Rashi doesn't always do pshat, but I think Rashi himself admits, Ula agadam yashev, and I don't just do pshat, I also do I also do midrash. What is Mendelssohn's concern about Rashbam? So he explains it further in his introduction to Parshat Mishpatim. I'll read it again in English again to save time, and we'll talk about this a little more next time, but I'll try to explain it quickly here, and then we'll see some examples next week. Rashbam began his commentary on this profound and wide-ranging commentary by writing, this profound and wide-ranging parsha, Torah portion, by writing, let those who love wisdom know and understand that my purpose, as I explained in Genesis, is not to offer halachic interpretations wherein haggadot and halachot are derived from superfluities in scriptural language. Even though such interpretations are the most essential ones, some of these explanations can be found in the works of my mother's father, Rashi. So this is Rashbam's introduction to Mishpatim. I'm not writing halachot here. I know that halachot are the most important way of understanding the text, but I'm not going to be writing halachot. You want to see halachot? Read Rashi's commentary on Mishpatim. I'm going to do something else he explains, but my purpose is to explain the plain meaning of scripture. Ani lefarish pshutan shel mikraot bati. It almost sounds as if he's playing on Rashi's language. Ani lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra. Rashbam says, no, it's I who has come to explain the plain meaning of scripture. I will explain the laws and rules of the Torah in a manner that conforms to the natural way of the world. Nevertheless, it is the halachic level of interpretation that is the most essential one, as the rabbi said. Halacha uproots the plain meaning of the biblical text. Halacha okeret mishnah. Which really should be, that's what it says there, but the text was later corrected to halacha okeret mikra. Halacha can uproot the plain meaning of the biblical text. So that's Mendelssohn quoting Rashbam. And then Mendelssohn says, we too will hover under the wings of the great eagle, Rashbam. I think he's the only person in history who referred to Rashbam as Hanesher HaGadol, as far as I know. It's usually Hanesher HaGadol is a reference to Rambam. But he's we will hover under the wings of Rashbam, as he did in his commentary, as we'll see a number of times he did in his commentary, and not depart from the plain meaning of scripture to the right or to the left. But we have not forgotten the principle which we laid down in the introduction to this work about the difference between contradictory explanations and differing explanations. When you offer two different interpretations of one biblical text, they can differ from each other or they can contradict each other. And he goes on to say, it is acceptable for the pshat to differ from the traditions of the rabbis, but it cannot contradict the rabbis in halacha or law. It is still possible for differing explanations to both be true, but with contradictory explanations, if one is true, the second one is certainly false. So whenever uncovering the pshat of scripture contradicts the traditions of the rabbis in the halacha or law, the commentator must totally abandon the pshat and follow tradition, or if possible, explain how the two explanations can be reconciled. We have made this the guiding principle of our commentary, and we will keep to it with God's help. Even though Rashbam didn't do this, even though Rashbam, on a number of times, explained the pshat in a way that contradicted the halacha, and we'll see examples of that next week. We'll see the examples of Rashbam doing that and Mendelssohn saying, we're not going to do that. We have laid it down as a principle that if pshat ever reaches a conclusion that contradicts the traditions of the rabbi, we abandon the pshat and we follow the traditions of the rabbi. Amazing. Moses Mendelssohn, who is seen by so many people as the enemy of Frum Judaism, is saying that Rashbam is not from enough. Rashbam, the great Bala Tosfot, the great Talmudic scholar who dedicated his life to Talmud and to Tosfot and to religious texts. For Moses Mendelssohn says, it's a logical fallacy in what Rashbam is doing. And I'm not going to do this in this commentary. I'm going to follow Rashbam a lot of the time, but I'm not going to follow him if it leads me against the traditions of the rabbis. And we will see examples of this next week. But at this point, maybe I'll stop for now, and Rabbi Kelman will tell me what kind of comments came in.
Okay. Okay, lived in Berlin, Dessau, then Berlin. Okay, the yeshiva world, maybe you sort of alluded to it, typically it says that he's the founder of the Reform Movement. If I can make a comment, you know there's something about him when the Reform claim he's Orthodox and the Orthodox claim he's Reform. But, you know.
Good for him.
I'm sorry.
He managed to do that.
Yes, I mean, we're all Reform in that sense. The fact that we're having this class in English would,
right.
Have we done right. This in Hungary 150 years ago, we would be excommunicated and we wouldn't be allowed to daven in our shuls. You comment, it's your class, but Rabbi Rakepet once made a comment, I thought, when I had him many years ago, and I thought it was insightful. He said that basically Mendelssohn and Hirsch are very similar. Mendelssohn was a little bit before his time. The community wasn't ready for him. And therefore, there was a lot of, the grandchildren, children converting. It just, they weren't ready. By the time Hirsch came along, the world had changed and they were ready to hear what Hirsch had to say. But in many ways, they were very similar. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I think that's very true. Yes.
Okay. Let's see what else. Somebody asking, Janine asking, is this debate, I guess, how much this impacted, you want to say, in our day school education, or is that more coming from out of Germany, the impetus for the kind of curricular and school atmosphere created in the Middle East, but I think everywhere, by the Lanz Israelite Universal. How did Mendelssohn impact? I think, Janine, tell me if I'm wrong, if I understand your question correctly, how Mendelssohn impacted on the development, I would say, of the day school movement, the future education.
Yeah.
And you have any comment on that, or?
I think that he did, that, the curricula that we teach are the curricula that the Enlightenment people wanted to see taught. The Jews who were opposed to Moses Mendelssohn basically have the approach that you can now find in Haredi circles. And that was the common model of religious observance. It was a Haredi kind of model that said that the only education that you really need is the Torah education. And there's no reason to learn the core subjects that are important to in the country in which we live, and so I think that our day schools are modeled on the curriculum that Moses Mendelssohn wanted.
Okay, somebody asking, which is sort of, you got to the end, but I have a comment. It's a commentary in the form of, I assume that means academic commentary. They use the traditional sources. Actually, what I found interesting, and I really have to thank you, and I guess I'm embarrassed to admit that I've never actually seen the inside of the Biur before until you put it on the screen. And I was actually a little bit surprised that it's written in Hebrew. He was Targum the Torah into German, but the Parshanu was Bifrit. That I did not know that. I had assumed it was in German, and I pardon my ignorance, but I thought that was quite interesting.
It's a compendium of, it's like Moses, much of it is Mendelssohn and his team's best of the Mikraot Gedolot. That comment that Mendelssohn was talking about, what does it mean to suffer for the sins of your parents, that's not from one of the Mikraot Gedolot commentators, but most of it is a compendium of the older commentaries.
Yeah, okay, I just point to that, if I may, Ham Nechama would always often say what you said, how the Pashtanim, they were so, like, when she talked about the repetition of the Torah, embraced all the stories, and even Ezra would just say, that's the way people talk. You say the story over again, you don't use the same language. And Nechama would go crazy, saying she misses the whole beauty. The Torah's writing it in, the nuance of the different. Sometimes the Pashtanim got too carried away. So that's, I don't know if Nechama picked it up from, Mendelssohn, but whatever. Okay. Yiddish language.
And everybody knows here, I'm sure, who studied Nechama, that she does quote Mendelssohn frequently in her
Yeah. I'm reading her work. Benno Jacobs this year for the first time. I've had it in my library for 30 years, and I never opened it up. And Nechama used to quote Benno Jacobs, and he was, quote unquote, technically a reform rabbi, but you wouldn't know it from anything he writes. Quite fascinating. It was different time, the moderate reform, but anyways, okay. Yiddish language is German, so even the old days, way before Mendelssohn, Jews, Orthodox spoke German. Albeit a Jewish version, Judeo-German. Okay, I assume they spoke Yiddish because they didn't want to speak German. It's like they speak English today in certain, sections that are sort of, it's not exactly the same. Okay. Jude Deutsch, this with Teitsch Pasuk in Chumash way before Mendelssohn. What does Teitsch mean? Teitsch is to translate. No, I don't know.
Yes, it's translated into Yiddish. So they were doing this, but Mendelssohn wanted there to be like an official German version of the Chumash. And Breuer and Sorkin explain in their book that some of the Jews were beginning to use, they wanted a German translation, and they were beginning to use Christian translations into German. And Mendelssohn decided that it would be better for them to be using a Jewish translation into German.
By the way, it's interesting. Mark Shapiro in his weekly class this week and last week, referring to a letter he had to him and Menashe Klein. Now, he corresponded with really a wide range of people. And Menashe Klein said, you're not allowed to teach Torah in English. Like, if you write a Torah article in English, it's worthless. Like, why would anybody write a Torah? You have to write, what about the Rambam? So he said, okay, but if they write it in Hebrew letters, that's different. In other words, what exactly, he wrote it in German, but it wasn't German. It wasn't the German alphabet. We write in English. Nobody, can you imagine writing English with Hebrew letters? Nobody in their right mind would ever do such a thing. So it's actually, I find it just quite amazing, you know, how, I mean, it's true. I heard from Eddie Broy, of course, you know, we know each other, of course, a long time ago in Toronto, Montreal, but it's, you know, we follow men, like you said at the beginning. I think anybody who comes to a Torah Motion class basically subscribes to Mendelssohn, even if they don't know it. You know, that's the sort of irony of this whole thing. Okay. Lauren pointed out, yes, there were many schools in Krakow, other places, and especially in Germany later on that had a secular subject. Believe me, in Hirsch's school, they learned less Gemara than they learned. The kids, when you did Talmud in chat, you did more Talmud than they did in Hirsch's school, for sure. It wasn't even close. Hirsch didn't believe Talmud was so important for the average Jew. Mm-hmm. A lot of people believe that till after World War II. Okay, I think that's pretty much all the question. Moore pointed out, yeah, sensitivity. Well, I guess you were talking about they were laughing at him. People took their racial, we identified people by where they came from. Hopefully we do that less and less today. I don't have to tell you that's, we haven't, whatever. I don't know if you call it racism. I don't know, whatever you want to call it, but people were very sensitive to race back then.
Right, but you know, I was just reading the newspaper today and seeing various French politicians talking about, can the Muslims ever actually become integrated and become part of French society? And you know, that same question was being asked about Jews in the 18th century. And Mendelssohn was standing there saying, yes, yes, yes. Jews can become integrated, and there were a number of Christians who said, no, it's impossible. They'll never become Germans. And so this issue hasn't gone away from the world. It's possible that Jews have convinced the democracies of the world that they can become part of the democracies of the world. That Mendelssohn succeeded ultimately, did not succeed right away, but he succeeded ultimately
with his other children, his student children, as opposed to his biological children. Yeah, that's we never know what will be. Okay, I think that's it for the question. Thank you very much. Really, we look forward to next week. This evening, Dr. Moshe Sokolov on the Haftorah of the week. We invite you to come every week. We analyze instead of the Parsha, the Haftorah. Tomorrow night, we'll have the Parsha Wendy Amsalem. We'll be giving the Parsha here. And tomorrow morning, Shuli Mishkin on her talk on the archaeology series. That's tomorrow at 11. So tonight at 8, not at 8:30 p.m., tomorrow at 11 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. We look forward to learning with you. We look forward to bringing your friends, let people know, and we look forward to seeing you on the Torah Motion Zoom channel, and everybody be well, be safe, and maybe now I can go check if anything new on the November 3rd, what happened yesterday in America.
I was going to say the same thing.
I haven't looked for now. Mark Hashem, away. We'll see what's going on in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, Michigan.
I believe they're calling Wisconsin for Biden at the moment.
So Wisconsin's tending. Okay, Wisconsin, everybody who doesn't want to hear politics can leave now. Now we have the political session.
I was just going to thank Biden, people, okay, the Americans who came, despite the fact that their election hasn't been decided, and to express the hope that by next Wednesday when we meet, maybe you will know who the next president is.
Within a day, I hope. if it does, whatever, we'll the market doesn't like uncertainty, as they say.
No, it doesn't.
Having a suffix, it just lends to whatever. Okay, everybody, the next election will probably be in Israel, probably.
Okay.
Before the one in Canada, even though we have a minority government too, but I think our government will, I think it's a little, will last a little longer than the one in
it's
Israel.
It's a little more stable than governments here.
Yeah, that's another fun election always in Israel.
Yes, sure.
Okay. All right. Enough. Everybody be well. Have a great, we have to lighten up a little bit, you know, after what can we do? You have to roll with the punches and make the best of what we can, do our best.
Right.
Okay. Have a great day, everybody. Be well. We look forward to hearing from
you. Bye-bye. Thank you all for coming.
Bye-bye.